As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today.
Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. I'm Michael Sacca.
I'm Joelle Steiniger.
And I'm Matt Goldman.
We're having 20-minute talks with entrepreneurs teaching you how to launch your product into revenue.
Check out our book at buildarocketship.com to reserve your launch discount and download a free chapter. Today we talked with Navid Alipour, co-founder and managing partner at Analytics Ventures here in San Diego. Navid is actually the first investor we've interviewed, and he had great insights into both the process behind venture funding as well as how angelist syndicates work, and how you can get involved either as an angel investor or as an entrepreneur seeking funding. Enjoy. We'd like to take a moment to thank our awesome sponsors. CodeShip makes continuous delivery simple and easy. Go to codeship.com/rocketship to get 20% off 3 months.
We'd also like to thank Envision App. Envision is by far the best prototyping and collaboration tool on the market. Go to envisionapp/rocketship to get the starter plan free for 90 days.
Customer.io is a modern email platform built for startups. Go to customer.io/rocketship to start sending emails that convert.
Welcome to the Rocketship Podcast. We're here with Navid Alipour, the managing partner at Analytics Ventures and principal at La Costa Investment Group. Navid, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. So you are the first investor we've had on the show, and I would love to get your background on how you got into investing in startup companies.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to share that. So I'll try to not be too long-winded about it. You know, I was at, came down to San Diego back in 96 to go to UCSD, went on to grad school at USD. I did my law and my MBA, and then I went more the traditional portfolio management route. You know, I was at Merrill, I was at Smith Barney, I was, you know, helping Fortune 500 companies to the CEOs and CFOs, you know, manage their company portfolios or personal assets. And so I met some interesting people. And in that process, a lot of obviously tech entrepreneurs that had good exits, and got involved with Connect here in town, which, you know, got me more exposed to the early stage startups. And I realized, well, I really did enjoy putting together portfolios for people of, you know, here's GE and Coca-Cola and Qualcomm in your portfolio and this hedge fund and that VC fund. What I really found I had a passion for was in helping some of these startups, you know, get to that point where they may get acquired by Qualcomm or AGE or who knows, become the next one. So long story short, I sold my practice in 2011, started La Costa Investment Group, went to some of those investors, and you know, we got that going and started doing deals here in San Diego and a couple in Silicon Valley and one in New York. And then my partner now and friend Blaise Barlett, who, you know, we kind of complement each other well. He, while I'm entrepreneurial, I've never started, well, I have co-founded some companies now, but I haven't had one that's IPO'd and got acquired by, you know, for close to $2 billion. So he was doing some investments and, you know, we complimented each other well and said, well, let's start Analytics Ventures. There's so much talent and brain power in San Diego. Let's pool these people together that are our friends and colleagues, and let's do some deals in San Diego and start some companies.
So why analytics specifically?
That's a good question. I think right now, without, you know, I mean, it's an overused word, but big data, right? But now with machine-to-machine communication and Internet of Things, there's going to be even more data. Right now, the majority of communication is human-to-human. I send you an email. You send a tweet. You share PDFs and files. In a couple of years, a majority of communication is going to be machine-to-machine. And there's going to be even more data, but it's all useless unless it's analyzed in real time. Sure, there's value to warehouse data, but increasingly, regardless of what vertical you're in, it could be energy analytics, restaurant analytics, weather analytics, it's going to become more and more important to get that information to either a human or a machine or have some automated process to, you know, get that value out of it. So if you're a guy, you know, I like to use local examples, at corporate headquarters here at Jack in the Box, you know, he knows the restaurant business cold. He says, with all this data, if I could analyze it in real time, I could save Jack in the Box $50 million. Well, then, you know, so what? So would McDonald's and Burger King and so forth. Now, that's just one example of, you know, one vertical. But we think, you know, analytics is going to be, you know, hitting every vertical. It already has. And we actually say, right, we're not energy experts. We're not weather experts. We're not gaming experts, but we like to find the people that are, and help them and support them and start companies or invest in ones that already exist.
So we had a couple of the founders that you've invested in on here, Leah from Leah at Metrics and Melanie from Bovada or Tap Hunter.
Yeah.
What is it about those founders that gets you excited and wants and makes you want to invest in that?
I'm not happy to get into those. And it's two very separate, you know, distinct companies. So with AppMetrics, Lee Jacobson was literally number two at Atari. He spent hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. He was the one that cut the check to do analytics for Atari. And they used Flurry and Contagion and Mixpanel and AppSlar and all of them. And none of them did quite what he wanted. And so he built AppMetrics and said, this is not only something that Atari would have paid for, but so would Square Enix and Konami Namco and Gamefly and every other gaming company. And oh, by the way, this is Lee talking. He happens to know a lot of them. And so, you know, that actually gets into what we look for is 85% of our decision is the team. So Lee was the expert. And then he got Mark, who's the CTO, and I would love to clone both of them. They're amazing. And so he was a Playdum, which Disney acquired for $750 million. And so Lee poached him from Disney and then, you know, built an amazing advisory board. Nolan Bushnell, founder of Atari, who, you know, comes down a couple of times and is always just so neat to have him around. So AppMetrics put together an amazing team, and he was the expert, so we felt very comfortable backing him.
Mm.
So in terms of looking at the team, it's one thing to be, you know, number two at Atari or super high up in a company where you have big connections, but what are some of the characteristics that you look for in the person themselves, and even someone who doesn't have a background at a big company that's sure. just getting started?
You know, one thing that really resonates for us is when, you know, they have humility. You know, I always like to say, I want to be the dumbest person in the room. I want to surround myself with people that are much smarter than me. And my wife says that's pretty easy to do, but all joking aside, is there's a problem if I'm the smartest one in the room. I want to have everyone else, you know, be, you know much more about their expertise. And be willing to replace themselves if that time comes. So if, you know, you take EcoATM, local company here, got acquired for $300 million by, they were called Coinstar. I forgot what they're called now. But, you know, the founder there has never been CEO of his own companies, if I'm not mistaken. He builds amazing teams. My partner, Blaze, has replaced himself 2-3 times as CEO, including the company that was successful. So take Lee as an example. If the time came, I think, if he said, if I replace myself as CEO, this company's going to go to the next level, I think a founder should be willing to do that, because at the end of the day, a title is just a title. If you replace yourself as CEO, that CEO works for you. You still own a shitload of equity, and that company's that's going to be worth more. So we look for that, for someone that's, it's not just, I mean, I understand it's their baby and it's their company, and but, you know, that lends itself to, you know, you mentioned Bovado, Tap Hunter. You know, I always joke around saying I would never invest in a husband-wife team. And, you know, in that situation we did, but they really complement each other well. And, you know, for us, it's, and that gets into, you know, the investor hat of, you know, valuation and where the company's at and what kind of monthly recurring revenue they were doing. And, I mean, Bovado was just on it. I mean, they had a model and they're like, we have this proven out. We're doing this amount in revenue. If we put some gas in the tank, we can hockey stick it. And they have. They've, you know, I'm not going to obviously get into her numbers they're doing, but they've exponentially, you know, they're doing fantastic.
Well, it seems like that characteristic is indicative of just being flexible in general. If you're willing to replace yourself, you're probably not the kind of person that's going to be totally married to an idea or some specific tactic. You're going to be willing to try whatever works.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And it does come back to that team. It can't be a one-man show. We really like companies that have two co-founders. You know, ideally the CEO and the CTO, and they complement each other and bring different things to the table. And it makes it so much, I mean, we like to say, if you take a good team, is the first level of importance, and then below that is money. And then it's the service or product. Because if there's, I mean, it's not always the best product or service that makes it to market, unfortunately, right? It's
yeah. That's very true.
It's the one that had the best team that can make it happen, whether it was their Rolodex or their investors' Rolodex, or they were better at closing deals. You know, so many intangibles. But if you have an amazing team and you give them money, they can change a mediocre service or product. They can pivot. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's not a deep team, then they could still succeed, but there's more risk as an investor mm-hmm. if you're investing in a subpar team, for lack of a better word.
When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. N. Backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rain was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination.
So how do you determine whether they are, whether they have these qualities in, say, a pitch? And maybe, like, is it one conversation that you guys have, or are you following them for a little bit before you make the investment?
Well, no, it's never just one conversation. And there's not a science to it. Sure, we have our due diligence list and we want to make sure, you know, the person hasn't screwed over investors and ran off to, you know, the South Pacific. And, you know, the nice thing being here in San Diego is San Diego is a big, small town. You have Mexico, ocean, desert, Camp Pendleton. So I think if you're a good person, people know. And if you're an asshole, people will find out, you know, your reputation. And so, That does kind of lead to kind of why we really like to invest here. The same reason that people in Silicon Valley prefer to invest in their own backyard. I mean, the joke up there is if you know, you're in Palo Alto, or if you're in you know, San Francisco, and you're talking to someone, you know, the investor in Palo Alto, they say you're too far. You got the wrong zip code. You got the wrong area code. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is up there, but. It kind of does make a little sense. Is you want to invest in people that you know and know people that know them, and so it does become kind of part of the due diligence to you know, vet the candidates.
Yeah,
but not candidates, the potential investment in the team members.
Yeah, and I feel like there's a lot of that going on. Outside of Silicon Valley, like, you hear about the startup communities in Austin and Denver and LA and Vegas, where Michael is now. And I think that there is this kind of growing trend that communities really want to build themselves up and not necessarily copy what Silicon Valley's doing, but be their own hub and kind of have their own spin on what they're all about in their startup communities.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously there's an incredible amount of talent up north, and I think it's okay to not be Silicon Valley, be a better San Diego, be a better Austin, be a better Boulder, be a better, you know, Seattle or LA. And, you know, just the way things are now, sometimes it's an advantage. I mean, we have a co-investor who is an early stage fund up in Silicon Valley. They refuse to invest up there. They only want to do early stage deals under a certain valuation outside of the valley.
Why? What was their motivation?
Theirs was that, yes, we're going to miss some great ones, but they say, you know, in their opinion, there's a bubble up there, and I'm not going to disagree with them. I mean, you know, the thing with bubbles is they last much longer than people expect. So, you know, they're 5 years, 10 years, who knows? But, you know, when as an investor, you're looking for, you're not a nonprofit. You want to get a return on your money. Mm-hmm. So if you can get a better valuation, you can get an earlier exit. So if you invest in a company, let's say under a $5 million, you know, convertible note cap, you know, valuation, if they get acquired for $50 million, you know, you made good money. But
yeah,
if you are the identical company in Silicon Valley, they raise money at a $10 million valuation, and then you get some bigger investors in there that for them to move the needle on their portfolio when they have hundreds of millions under management, they can't accept a $50 million exit. You know, they need to, because they got in at a 10, let's right. say, or a 20. You know, so now you get in that position where a company needs to either get acquired for hundreds of millions or, you know, IPO, and it closes the door on taking some singles and doubles and maybe triples. And so that's, I think, an advantage that everyone has over Silicon Valley in that sense, is sometimes the founder would love to sell and they can't because they have the big VC funds that are on the board, and they say, nope, that's not a good enough exit for us.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So if we're talking about kind of that early stage, you guys just started something that's really exciting there in San Diego, which is an AngelList syndicate that you guys are running. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, with the passage of the Jobs Act, which was, I could be wrong, but they said it was the biggest bipartisan act passed by Congress in like decades. So, you know, it happened, and, you know, everyone's kind of observing and seeing how it develops, because it was written very kind of loosely, so there's room for interpretation. And, you know, AngelList has really, the timing of AngelList is fantastic, and, you know, the value they add for startups and for investors. And so we're watching. We see, you know, funds that have been around longer, accelerators that have been around longer, like, you know, 500 startups or Foundry Group and Super Angels, mostly in the Valley, of course, start these syndicates. And so we said, well, why not? We can do that here in San Diego with the premise that we're going to invest here. We literally went live with it 2 weeks ago, a soft launch, just sent a few emails to some friends. And as of today, it's, you know, at $160,000, which doesn't sound like a lot, but 500 startups is at, I think, 500,000. So
yeah,
and they're much more mature than us. So our goal is to be able to really build the syndicate out, and that way we can do more deals here. And again, we're not going to do more deals for the sake of doing more deals. It still has to make sense, but.
Right.
We were talking about earlier, it's if you're comparing two companies and it's apples and oranges, you might really like both of them, but there's only so many deals you can do. But as we get the syndicate, that'll kind of allow us to back more companies.
And so how do you use the syndicate? You know, for the people listening, you have your venture fund. How do you decide where the syndicate invests and where your venture fund invests?
Well, you know, just to be totally clear, we just went live with a syndicate and we haven't backed a deal yet on it. We want to build it up first. So if someone goes on AngelList and says, okay, I want to back Foundry Group's syndicate or this angel syndicate that was at Google or Analytics Venture syndicate, when you're a backer, you commit to, like, let's say I'll do $5,000 in each deal or $10,000. The investor can never do a deal, but they get the opportunity to see each investment that syndicate is doing and choose if they want to participate or not.
I see.
So you're not going to get every single backer to invest in every deal you do on AngelList. So we want to first build out the syndicate and then on our backer list and then start doing some deals.
So you guys are basically choosing what comes in the top of the funnel, and then they decide what they want to fund.
Yeah. So once we say, okay, we're investing in this deal, mm-hmm. And our backers can get in at the same terms we do. So that's a nice thing about AngelList is they get the exact same terms we do, right? So if we get in at a 5 cap, every single backer, whether they put in $25,000 or $1,000, will get in at the same. And so what's really nice about that is, I mean, there's a lot of people that are accredited investors and a commercial real estate guy, an attorney, a doctor, and they might say, I'd love to do invest in startups and allocate $25,000 a year to startups. But frankly, I'm embarrassed to cut a check for less than $10,000 to a startup, but I want to diversify and invest $5,000 a year into five companies. And so now through AngelList, they can do that by backing syndicates, and whether it's us or other ones, and they could pick and choose, right? You can, you don't have to be a backer for just one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it really does, I think, open up a lot of doors, and I think it's fantastic for, I mean, to look at it at a macro level. I mean, everyone worries about the U.S., you know, falling behind and China taking the lead. It's like the 80s, everyone thought the Japanese were taking over, right? Well, I mean, we have a lot of problems here, but I'd rather live here and invest here and build companies here compared to anywhere else in the world, because it's just such an incredible place to, you know, it's the beauty of capitalism. It's such a great place to innovate, and you know, there is the more safety with our, you know, legal system than anywhere else. And with AngelList now, it's going to be able to fund so many more startups, I think, because that example I said, the commercial real estate guy that would love to invest $25,000 a year, but is embarrassed to cut a check for less than $10,000, so he doesn't. Yeah. And also, he's not a tech person, so he doesn't know where to invest. He doesn't, might as well go to Vegas and, you know, bet on black. Mm-hmm. And so this way he said, okay, well, I'm going to back, you know, Bradfeld Syndicate. I'm going to back, you know, the founder of Tumblr Syndicate, or, you know, us, what, you know, whatever it is that they say, okay, these people are doing the due diligence. They're putting their own money in at the same terms. I feel comfortable now investing. So that's going to, I think, really give a kick to the economy and to startups. And, you know, that's.
And I think it's going to go a long way too for communities where people may have been scared to invest locally when they know all the big companies are coming out of San Francisco or New York or whatever. To see syndicates and local venture funds investing locally, putting your own money in, I think it's going to break down some of those barriers and some of that fear around putting $10,000 into someone in your backyard.
You're absolutely right. And people, at the end of the day, I think there is a comfort level to investing in your own backyard and, you know, knowing the people that are involved. And so there, with that increased level of comfort, it is going to bring money to the table that was not available before for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, well, I'm incredibly excited by what you guys are doing right there in San Diego. And it's definitely brewing. There's definitely something brewing down there. And it's nice to see people being proactive and really trying to move the needle down there. So tell everyone who's listening, where can they keep up with you online?
Online, whether, you know, I'm on Twitter or I'm on AngelList. One thing that always surprises me on that note, I'm going to go on a tangent here, is when you get a LinkedIn invite from someone you don't know and it's just the generic, I'd like to connect on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't fucking know you. Like, it's weird, right? Because now there's also spam. There's LinkedIn spam. And
well, and then what's also weird is you'll see that you know, like, 10 people in common.
Yeah, but then, and so I, every now and then I get one of those, and I'm just out of curiosity, I'll ask someone that I see as a common connection, like, do you know this person? Like, I have no idea who that is, right? Yeah. So you get some of that, too. But, you know, I've if I send someone a LinkedIn request that I don't know, or I want to meet someone, I would go to see who we have in common and say, hey, can you introduce me to so-and-so for XYZ reasons? I thought it would be great for us two to connect. And, you know, that works. You'd be surprised how many times that works. And people want to, I think most people are pretty helpful at the end of the day. Now you're always going to get the one that has to stick up his ass or her ass and like they're not. And so forget it. You don't want to deal with them. But it's like there's so many people that are examples of people following each other on Twitter and then kind of forming a relationship there, right? And then it moves to the next level to LinkedIn, and who knows, meeting in person. And so I think Twitter and LinkedIn are just such amazing tools. And AngelList too now, because it is a social kind of aspect to it, right? On the
We say all the time that we couldn't do what we do without Twitter.
Yes, I don't think we would be in business without Twitter.
Yeah.
No. It reminds me of, have you seen that the BMW commercial where the guy, it shows him like in high school and he's this amazing girl. Oh. And he's like, yeah, I think we're done, Taylor. And it's like Taylor Swift. And then he sees her on TV and she made it. And then his friends call him and he's like, yeah, you got to invest in this. He's like, 140 characters? Nah, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
And then it shows that friend fast forward on a yacht with like a glass of champagne. And he's like, see, I told you should invest. And,
I think I've seen that one.
It's pretty funny, but I mean, that's, you know, Twitter's one of those, you know, they call them the unicorns, right? There's only a few a decade, few Twitters or Googles or LinkedIns or Facebooks. And, you know, that's actually is another thing that we look at when we're, vetting a company to invest in or not, or the team, is it's a little scary once, you know, you meet someone and they think they're going to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, or they're like, we're going to be the next LinkedIn, you know? It's, I'd rather hear that guy or gal say, we're going to build something and get to this level of traction and LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter is going to buy us. Mm-hmm. That's a heck of a lot more likely than them becoming that Twitter or Uber or Facebook. Now, hey, if that happens, fantastic, right? But more often than not, it's like, you know how many companies get acquired for $50 million, $100 million, $200, $75 million? You know, there's a lot of money to be made there without becoming a billion-dollar company in the next Facebook or Twitter. So that's another thing. Like when you're trying to find someone who's a good entrepreneur, seasoned, they're not delusional. Although, I mean, every entrepreneur has to be delusional, or we wouldn't
to some
do,
extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think I read that once. It was a definition of an entrepreneur is someone who's delusional, because every other reason says you should stop. And
really, why the hell would you do this?
Yeah, why would you do? Why would you? Do you like torturing yourself? Right. So, do you want to have a life? But.
It's so true.
So yeah, you do have to be delusional to a certain point, but
yeah. Or in the case of Mel Gordon's team, they're not saying that they're going to be the next X. They're coming to you with a product that has revenue.
Absolutely.
Saying, with this, we could achieve this.
Absolutely.
It's not. We're going to build this thing that's going to be huge. You don't even know.
No, you're right. And so there's, and that's the good thing about getting in early. You know, AppMetrics was pre-revenue when we invested, but I mean, the company could be a $300 million company. I mean, Flurry just got acquired by Yahoo for $300 million. Yeah. Obviously, they were farther along. But, you know, in with Mel's company, with Bovado and their app TapHunter, it's just one of those things where they had revenue and they had this amazing model, and it doesn't have to get acquired for $100 million or $50 million, frankly, for investors and the founders to make a lot of money. That one was amazing, because we would be at we were meeting with one of our other companies, with Leah, actually, David Warren over at Leah, and his office is in the old Mission Brewery building on Washington by the airport. And then there's that 57 degrees, for those of you in San Diego, that is that wine bar. And so we were early. We didn't want to interrupt him, so we went to have a glass of wine. My partner's French, so he uses that as an excuse to drink wine anytime.
Yeah.
And so we're sitting there, and we saw they have beers. And we're like, oh, you guys have beers. He's like, oh, yeah, we got all these craft beers. I'm like, have you heard of TapHunter? And this guy, I mean, and this is kind of part of our due diligence for something like that, is whichever bar or restaurant we were in, he's like, hey, have you heard of this TapHunter thing?
Yeah.
And just play dumb. And they will give you, you know, their 2 cents. And in that case, we're like, is there anything you don't like about it? And it's like, no, I love it. And like if they doubled the price, would you pay it? And the guy kind of hesitated, and he's like, we told Mel this and Flash, and he's like, well, maybe not double, but yeah, if they raise it this much, I would still pay for it. And so then you're like, okay, you know, these guys are onto something.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's really cool. All right, cool.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Bye.
Bye.